Hi everyone, it's Bill here with another episode of The One With The Podcast, your local friendly TV chat. And I'm here with my good friend Nathan Cooper. Hi Nathan, how's things?
Hi Bill, how's things? Everything's going well. Had a decent week and slowly but surely getting back to reality.
Hey, I like it. I like the wee teaser there. Yeah, the weather's been absolutely fantastic here in Northern Ireland, if you're listening further afield. We don't normally get good weather. It's kind of weird. It's like somebody's left an oven on for most of us. But it's been nice. Have you been out in the sun yourself?
I have, yeah. I have been working the entire time, so once I got back, spent a few hours out in the sun, having a dinner and stuff out there. As I say, it's just like next door's house is on fire or something, the heat that's coming off it. It's a bit strange.
it's very weird, a Northern Irish summer. It really is. And, you know, as everybody knows, we're kind of in the midst of the COVID-19 outbreak, which is global, worldwide. But we're getting through it slowly but surely. Bits and pieces are coming back. And speaking of which, I mean, just our episode that we're going to talk about today is one of our favorite TV shows. And yeah, it's sort of, we chose this one because it's a bit of a shout out to the future, because let's face it, the present and the past isn't so hot at the minute. So the TV show that we're going to talk about today is Red Dwarf. And just a special treat for you guys, let's hear the theme tune. But wait, Bill, that's the original theme tune. Did it not have a second theme tune? Yes, it did. Here's the second theme tune for all you people. And we're back. Nathan, what sort of memories does the theme tune bring back?
So last week, I actually phoned my mum and we were talking about, I was going to do an episode on Red Dwarf and the sort of growing up, like I was a kid, I was 3 years old when this was on, and in the background, growing up, always remember the theme tune, used to sing it before I went to bed to like my granny and my granddad, my mom and dad when I was 3, 4, 5, you know. So it brings back memories in terms of just almost like emotional sort of thing. It was so intricate in my early life, that theme song, you know. I have a real emotional attachment to that theme tune, you know.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I mean, yes, you're a bit younger than me. I'm not going to say what age I am. I'm not going to say what age you are. Shut up. You're a little bit younger than me, just a wee bit. But yeah, I mean, Red Dwarf, it started life on BBC Two in 1988. And to give you a little bit of an indication of what age I was in second year when this started. And I can remember that myself and all my other wee geeky mates at the time, we loved this. I mean, this was, it's kind of weird. I mean, the theme tune, especially the first incarnation, What's the word? The first kind of theme tune incarnation of the theme tune. It's very dark and moody, and you know, even the open title screen, it's not something that would have screamed, "Hello, I'm a comedy," essentially.
Yeah,
I mean, that's what I remember from it. It was such a big surprise that, yeah, sat through this because it was space. It was heavily into Star Wars and all sorts of science fiction-y stuff anyway. And then this came on and I watched it and I thought it was maybe going to be some sort of drama, you know, something along the lines of Incredible Hulk or the Triffids or something like that. You're probably a little bit too young for the Triffids. But I remember them boys. They were nasty. Like. But then it was full of laughs, and you know, the sitcom itself, it had a laugh track. So you knew at what points to laugh at, which was one of the things that sort of I, you know, as a kid growing up, this was the stuff of the playground. You went out, you quoted all the lines to your mates and flying around and Red Dwarf and Blue Midget. And then later on it was Starbug and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, as I say, like with it being so integral in my early life, coming across one person growing up, like either in my class or somebody outside of school that actually knew what Red Dwarf was a big deal, you know. Same as a kid, love Star Wars, love space, and sort of just to tie in what you were saying there about the soap opera sort of thing, it it was, that's the premise of it. It is like a sitcom in space, and the actual reality of it, where if you know the story, where Lister's, you know, in stasis for millions of years, but and there's a drive failure, and he's the last human in existence
that we know of.
Yes, but from what you're told in the early, like that's quite bleak.
Yeah,
you know,
there's actually. For the listeners out there, I'll just briefly break down what Red Dwarf is. Red Dwarf was a BBC comedy set. It was set in the year 2200 and something. And you basically had this, Red Dwarf was a ship that had, in the early days, it had like 167 crewmates. And they were part of a company called the Jupiter Mining Corporation. And essentially what they did, they just mined planets for resources to send back to the big giant corporations of Earth. It was kind of like a Blade Runner-esque kind of look at the future. Things were kind of bleak. Mankind was out to the stars, but still big corporations ruled the roost. So essentially you had this one character. I'll take you through characters as well. You had Dave Lister. Then you had, he was the lowest of the low on the ship. He was like the, what was it, third technician or something on the ship.
Vending machine technician.
It's a vending machine, just making sure that the chicken soup machine was refilled and the nozzles weren't clogged, you know, that kind of stuff. And his immediate superior was a guy called Arnold Rimmer, who had such an air of pomposity about him that, you know, obviously, you know, chalk and cheese, the two, you know, immovable object, unstoppable force, that never the twain shall meet, they hated each other from start to finish. And then you had, suppose those are the two main characters. And then what happens is there's an accident on the ship. Prior to the accident, Lister gets into trouble because he smuggles a cat, a black cat called Frankenstein, onto the ship. So it's contraband. And because of that, he doesn't give up the whereabouts of where he's hidden the cat. So he's put into stasis. And basically for him, time stops and he'll stay there until the ship goes back to Earth, 2 years, 3 years without pay. And that's his punishment. But unfortunately, there's an accident and the whole crew gets wiped out. And then Dave Lister awakes 3 million years later. He is the last human. So he comes out of stasis. He's alone on the ship. The ship's been drifting along for 3 million years. And one of the first people that he meets is the cat, which is an evil, it's a humanoid evolution of the Holy Mother Frankenstein. So immediately the show goes into this sort of religious air. One of the other characters as well is the ship's computer, Holly, which, you know, to look at him is just a senile old man with no hair. He's just this lifeless head as a computer AI. He's supposedly got the IQ of 6,000. After 3 million years, that IQ has quite dropped. And so that's where, that's what Red Dwarf is. You've got humanity in the future, 3 million years. That's it in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of comedy to be gleaned from that, though.
when you think
about it.
No, there isn't. But again, that sort of speaks volumes of the writing style and how the comedy is injected into that environment. You know, it's brilliant work at the end of the day, you know, as a comedy piece, you know.
It absolutely is. I mean, we say that there's not a lot of comedy there, but there actually is. I mean, a lot of comedy is written around conflict, and there's so much conflict in this. One of the things I didn't actually say, Arnold Rimmer, although he dies, he actually comes back as the ship's hologram.
Yeah, he's there to keep Lister company. Holly brings him back.
Holly brings him back. So immediately we're given these sort of, I suppose these familiar concepts. I mean, any sort of sci-fi nut worth their salts knows about these kinds of things, holograms and artificial intelligence. And later on, you know, we get into robotics and things like that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it's quite interesting where a lot of the comedy comes from. I mean, it is essentially, it's almost like the New World. It's that kind of comedy where we're seeking, you know, Lister's the last man alive. He's trying to get home to Earth. He's 3 million years away. How's he going to do it? How's he going to get home? And I think that's where a lot of the genius and the writing comes in. Just a wee tidbit. Although Red Dwarf itself is science fiction, a lot of it's set out in space and things like that. One of the rules that the makers, Rob Grant and Doug Naylor, had was they didn't want aliens. No aliens at all. So yeah. Throughout the whole lifetime of Red Dwarf, and even recently, there are absolutely no aliens. All life that is met is either, if it's biological life, it's something that's been man-made.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's mechanical life, again, it's something that was man-made.
Yeah.
So there's no, you know, there's no aliens or anything like that, which is kind of, you know, it's kind of a bold choice when you think about it, because I'm sure there's so much, you know, you look at the likes of Rick and Morty, the amount of humor that they get by visiting different alien races.
Mm-hmm.
We don't get that in Red Dwarf.
Yeah, I think immediately they painted themselves into a box, and that sort of the space that they can find in that area is actually incredible. You know, it's hard to believe Red Dwarf is still going today, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, it ran for 8 seasons on BBC from 1988 all the way through to, I think it was 99, I think, I believe. Yes, it was. It was 99 mm-hmm. that it actually finished. So that's like 21 years ago that it finished. And then it was revived by the UK TV station Dave in, I think it was 2009 or 2008. And it's frightening to think that, you know, it had such a break in that kind of time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it still came back very, very strong.
Yeah, it definitely did. And in the early years, where there was a lot of rivalry between, I know we're sort of talking about the concept of the show, but where it came from was BBC London and BBC, was it Manchester? Had a hell of a, there's a big rivalry. They always wanted to have the biggest, the next big best thing. And basically they kept pitching Red Dwarf as basically the odd couple in space sort of thing, you know, that sort of conflicting relationship sort of thing. And it just kept getting rejected. But I think it was it Birmingham ran with it in the end, wasn't it? Or was it Manchester? Sorry, I can't remember.
I can't actually remember. I think it might have
It was
been, it was,
one of them.
yeah, but
And they basically,
it was definitely one of those big studios in BBC,
yeah.
and they kind of took, it was one of those things where they kind of took a chance
They
on
did,
something,
yeah.
because essentially what the BBC policy was back then, back in the 80s, was that if a sitcom or show got greenlit for the for its first season, then they automatically kept the money aside for the second season, because they were
Yeah.
kind of the, you know, it was the 80s, it was time, there was money flying around everywhere, and they kind of had, you know, kind of had the money, and they thought that, they pretty much thought that everything was going to be a sure thing. But what happened was, there was Ben Elton had a sitcom called Happy Families.
Happy families, yeah.
Happy Families in, I think it was around 1986. Or no, it's not 86, 88. It was an 88 or so. And what happened was that they didn't actually renew the series. So there was this pot of money sitting there, and they basically said, "Well, we do have the money. Go make your series."
Yeah.
And the rest is actually history. You always hear about these stories of David and Goliath kind of thing,
Yeah.
and
Well,
just all these obstacles, and just everything sort of fell into, like Tetris, like a nice game of Tetris, just everything
Oh,
fell into place for them.
yeah. One thing that I found really interesting was where they found Craig Charles, which who plays Lister.
Yep.
Originally, he auditioned for the Cap,
Yeah.
and a lot he behind the scenes in the local sort of art scene, he was a big poet.
He was a
He
punk
was
poet.
a punk poet, which is
Yeah.
pretty cool.
I actually remember seeing him on TV around 1985, 86. And it would have been one of those Saturday morning shows, like Get Fresh or Number 73 or something like that, way before your time, Nathan.
Oh yeah, I
But
wasn't
you
even
know,
born.
I remember those sorts of things. And you know, Saturday mornings were big, and he
Yeah.
was a guest on it doing one of his poet or poems. That was really, really interesting, you know.
Yeah. If you look him, if you look him up on YouTube, one of his famous ones, which is quite relevant actually to what's happening in today's society, is about, being a young sort of black man growing up in the UK and stuff at that period. You know, if you look that up, it's quite pretty good stuff. But he originally auditioned to be the Cap, and they were impressed. They were like, right, this guy doesn't have skill. You know, we'll maybe try and give him Lister's lines and we'll see. And then from there, they were like, actually, they didn't want Lister to be from Liverpool. He didn't want him to be a Scouser, but it just worked, you know. And very famously as well, Alan Rickman was meant to be Rimmer,
Yeah,
but
that's
he was
right.
edged out by Chris Barry, or did a conflict or something with something else, another
Yeah,
project.
I think maybe something happened. Alan Rickman might have got a film role or a play role or something, and that's just where he sort of fell by the wayside. Alfred Molina was another one that actually auditioned for the role of Rimmer. So, you know, you could see that this show behind the scenes was gathering a bit of momentum
Momentum,
and a
yeah.
bit of interest from, you know, these guys aren't, you know, they're not just, you know, backstreet actors. I mean, these are top Shakespearean British actors, and that's the kind of gravitas that, you know, the scripts, I suppose, were pulling. Yeah, you mentioned about Craig Charles. The interesting thing I found about that story was that Craig Charles was actually asked for his opinion on the cat, in that the writers and the producers were a bit worried that the cat was possibly a racist character. And the reason I bring that up for two reasons. One is the climate that we're in today. There's a lot of protesting about Black Lives Matter and things like that, which we fully support here on this podcast. But also bring it up for the other reason that with Craig Charles being cast, the way that he was and the character that he is, I mean, that's the leading role. He was probably one of the first, black leading characters on British television.
And to think that that could have went to anybody else, looking back, like it wouldn't have been the same, you know.
It would not have been the same, and it would have made things very, very different. And no spoilers, not going to spoil things, but there's a couple of episodes where we do sort of go through that, process of maybe seeing a different Lister and a different, parallel worlds and all that sort of stuff, which is kind of cool, But yeah, I mean, it's kind of weird how all that happened. Chris Barry was working on, Chris Barry, fantastic, always has been very good at voices. He was actually one of the main guys on Spit and Image,
Spot an image, yeah.
and that's how some of the producers knew him and knew of him because they'd worked with him previously. So yes, he became Arnold Rimmer, the man, the myth, the legend, the smeghead, as they call. And your man Holly, I mean the robot or the AI Holly, it was played by Norman Lovett, who was a stand-up comedian. Believe it or not, he was actually a very, very popular stand-up comedian. Very deadpan, very morose, very sort of
Dry.
miserable, dry. And he auditioned for Rimmer originally, as a lot of other people did, as we know. But then he got offered Holly, and he took it. And it's kind of weird. You can't really see anyone else in that role, but wait.
They were saying very famously, he was very sort of adamant that Holly needed a physical form to be, for physical comedy. And initially, the writers didn't write Holly as an actual character you would see. He was just going to be an AI and a voice, and that was it. But his sort of comedic sort of gravitas and the way that he would present things and sort of put things over in the pitch in writers' meetings, again, it's hard to believe that if Norman didn't do that, we wouldn't have Holly, basically,
Absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, yes, I don't really want to go into spoiler zone, but again, it's a sci-fi show. Anything can really happen. If you've watched anything like we've mentioned, Rick or Morty or anything like that, you'll already know about some of the concepts in Red Dwarf. And to be honest, Red Dwarf was there first, so take that.
My oldest sister Lindsay, she was like our whole family were into it, even my youngest brother, who was it was way before his time, but my older sister, she went into the BBC shop in Belfast at the time, and she had bought this t-shirt off Lister with a bazookoid, and I actually still have it to this day. I nicked it. She's gone. If you're wondering where it is, Lindsay, I have it. Sorry about that. But I still got that. And we had a few of the books as well. They were well read, and just growing up in our family, and we have the Starbugs, with fridge magnets. There was so much things, right down to toys and stuff. We had models, toys, you name it, we had it. And again, that's a big testimony to how much of an influence it had on our family, and it's something we all sat down to watch. And I
Yeah,
knew, being so
I remember
young,
that. Yeah.
I didn't get half the jokes, but
Yeah.
I could appreciate Crichton. I could appreciate the cat, the physical comedy of it, as well.
Yeah.
And even looking back, there's still things I know what's going to happen. I still laugh, and
Absolutely. That's
that's
the
timeless.
testament. That's the testament of a good comedy, though. Not only should it be quotable and things like that, but it's things that have good memories. And like you say, sitting down with the family, sort of plotting your week around, sitting in front of that television. I think it was on a Thursday night, 9 o'clock on BBC Two. And I was sitting, would have sat with my mum and dad watching it, and we all knew what it was. We'd all laugh at things, and as you rightly said, that there's maybe some jokes that you might not have got because you were too young, but you get them now. You get them now. You do get them now. And I suppose one of the other characters that we haven't really covered is Crichton. And don't want to spoil too much. Crichton, if you haven't watched Red Dwarf, you need to get this into your life now. It's on Netflix. It's currently all on Netflix, so you can get there. Red Dwarf is currently on Netflix, so you have no excuses whatsoever. But Crichton comes in a little bit at the end of season two, but he comes in season three, and Crichton is a Series 4000 mechanoid who has designed clean toilets. But I want to go through some of the concepts that the Red Dwarf has bought us. It is science fiction. There's a lot of stuff in it that is sort of straight out of science fiction, straight out of Star Trek, straight out of Silent Running, that sort of thing. But there's a lot of touching moments and a lot of emotion as well. There's a particular episode there, there's a lot of stuff about love, existence, humanity, lifespan, things about memory as well. There's stories about, how we process thought, things like that. Some of the stuff is quite highbrow, but some of the stuff can be quite lowbrow as well, which, we all like a good toilet joke, or a good bodily function joke, especially with vomit and Jackson Pollocks and things like that. But it does sort of cover a lot of the spectrum of what it's like to be human, which is, I suppose, again, this comes back to, again, this is comedy writing 101. You want to try and make, if you can try and get the audience to emote with you, they will follow you wherever you go. And I think Red Dwarf does that really well. We do have the perfect, I suppose, fall guy for humanity, which is Dave Lister, the last of his species, the last human. And it is, there are moments where we feel for him that, he is really sad at times, life and loss and things like that. And
I think they sort of they paint the picture of bleakness, and in not going into it too much, but in the early episode it tells you all about the crew, Lister's friends, who he's romantically involved with and where he wants to go, and it tells you it builds up his whole aspirations and his journey and where what he wants to do, and tragically it's all taken from him and there's no way of getting any of that back, and he has to get on with life and maybe realign what he actually wants to try and achieve or to go and do, and I think that that is life
It
in
is.
reality.
It
Things
is.
happen and things that are out of our control, and ultimately with it being played out in space at thousands of years in the future, all of it is relevant to now and today.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of truth in the comedy. And you're right in saying the first, I would say the first season is a lot about his existence and his loneliness to a certain extent. And it's the later seasons that, you know, we get the first couple of seasons are all sort of set around Red Dwarf, the ship itself. But later on, we do actually get out and about in the space. We find other derelicts. We find other planets. We find other life forms. And there's a lot of interaction, a lot of comedy in there as well. And I like a lot of the stories. Like, good science fiction for me anyway, is it's teaching you something about the here and now. Yeah. It's got something to say about what's happening in the moment right now in the world. And I think Red Dwarf does that really well. And it also looks at history as well, and some of those concepts. You know, there is that, you know, the trope of time travel and,
yes, you
know, and possibly enlightened beings and a few other sort of familiar avenues there. It doesn't really, for me, I don't think there's any poor episodes.
Yeah, they're all watchable, and I think a lot of them are relatable as well, you know, and there's no real filler as well. They're quite unique that way.
Yeah, I mean, it does sort of follow the typical sitcom template in that everything resets, but there is almost like an overarching story as well, in that Lister is trying to get home, and he does get there sometimes, but maybe it's not what he thought it was.
Yeah.
You know, it's that playing with, I think you covered it anyway, and that in terms of life changes and you change with it. Mm-hmm. So your needs and yourself become something different.
Yeah. You know, again, no spoilers, but whenever Lister finally achieves something, or he gets to somewhere, or he meets somebody that he thinks he's going to be happy with, you know, something changes, or he scratches the surface and he realizes it's not what he needs or wants. And it's the whole thing with the direct comparison of what he had, what he wants, and what he has. It's, you know, it's interwoven the whole way through all the series, even right up to the latest series, the fairly recent ones. And to keep that thread of not only continuity, but to keep that thread of his bleakness and, you know, his loneliness, and he's still learning about himself, even though he's the last man.
Yeah, it's very interesting how they keep everything fresh. I mean, yes, some of the characters have come and gone, and some of them had facelifts and that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, we talked about that it started life on the BBC, and essentially there were 8 series on BBC. And then it moved in 2009, I think it was, it moved to Dave. And they started with a 3-part special called Back to Earth. And again, we don't want to go into spoiler territory here, but it's, you know, it's fairly self-explanatory, but it's very meta as well. And it's very based around Blade Runner.
Yeah.
And Coronation Street. Of all things, it's an absolute. Now, this was a 3-parter, Nathan, that divided people. People were glad to see Red Dwarf back after a period. You know, it was off the screens for 10 years, but about half of the people were let down by this. Now, yeah. Personally, I think it's very good. I like it. I really do like it. I think it's top notch stuff.
Right. As a collective, I know my family initially didn't get it, and we kind of rejected it, and we were like, oh, they ruined it. But looking back now, you know, having, you know, fresh eyes and sort of having that sort of reinvigorated adoration for, you know, at the end of the day, it's a cult show. It has a cult following.
Yes, it does. You know,
there's conventions that meet
for Red Dwarf. Yes, there are. Yes, there are, Nathan. It's fantastic. I mean, the support that the show has worldwide is phenomenal. The only real reason I bring Back to Earth into it is because it was their first time doing something different, and it was really, you know, it kind of changed. Didn't really change the story, but I suppose it changed how they made it. It was more, I think it was more driven by drama.
Yeah.
It was also more driven, you know, they had a bit more money, so they could do more effects. Because the original two or three series, they didn't have a lot of money, and it kind of shows in the set pieces and the, you know, special effects and things like that. Whereas this, they were able to show what they could do with a budget. It's almost like a movie, this three-parter.
Yeah.
And it is, for me, it's an epic adventure. It's a good, it's a really good story. I really enjoy it. Some good cameos as well. But the one thing that really strikes me about it is that the characters and even the actors themselves have grown. And I'm not saying older. I'm not saying they've got older. We all get older, but they've got better. They're like a fine wine in terms of acting. I think the performances of the main cast they're hard to beat, especially Craig Charles. I mean, you're talking about a guy that wasn't an actor. He was a poet. And the first 5-10 minutes of that Back to Earth, it would tear your heart out of your chest. The acting and the emoting that guy's doing, he's fantastic. And I think they're all fantastic. And I don't think that comes across as well for some reason. I don't know why.
I think they're, you know, as you say, the maturity of how the acting is given, but not even that. It's the writing. The writing of the characters has came a long way, I think, in those episodes. However, one negative thing, as you say, it's like a movie. One thing that I did notice is they removed the laughter track.
Yes, they did.
And it was,
but
like,
that's not the first time they removed it, though.
It was. I know, but that's again ingrained in my appreciation of the show. There was that laughter track in the background, you know, and not having it, you know, it's certainly noticeable.
It is. But moving on from Back to Earth, because it was a success, whether people liked it or not, you know, they watched it. They watched it in their millions, and Dave commissioned a 6-part series. And because of the success of that, we actually got series 11, 12, and 13.
Mm-hmm.
Which is fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. And we actually got, just there this year, we got our TV film, The Promised Land. Did you watch it?
Yeah, I did.
I have to admit, Nathan, I think it's some of the best Red Dwarf that they could have done. It's got everything. It's got action. It's got humor. It's got suspense. It's got emotion. Yeah. It's got feeling. It's really, there's some really nice interchanges between Rimmer and Lister. Now, whether that's, you know, those guys know each other well now, you know, they've known each other now for over 30 years. So they, you know, they're in sync, but it's that kind of, you know, they're obviously comfortable on screen together. And that's the scene in particular that I'm thinking of. It's a very emotional scene. And I thought it played out very, very well. Yeah. I thought the whole TV movie was fantastic. Again, I'm not going to spoil, tell you what the story is. If you haven't seen it, go and see it. Please, go and see it. Yeah. Now.
The whole thing with Craig Charles and Chris Barry at the start as well, you know, we're just talking about their two characters that initially they were the two main characters. These two guys actually didn't see eye to eye. They didn't actually like each other particularly well, you know, in the early days. But I think as their relationship grew on screen, it did off screen too. And that respect really came through from both of them. And you know, that conflict maybe off stage actually made their performance maybe a bit better as well, you know, in terms of delivery and how things are sort of the dynamic and how things were given and taken, you know, in the lines. But there, Red Dwarf is brilliant. The whole, that whole theme, we've sort of touched on it there, that whole theme of conflict between those two guys. And then they have the episode Marooned, which basically, again, sort of half spoiler alert, not much happens in it in terms of actions. And but in terms of story progression and character development, it's arguably one of the greatest single episodes I've ever seen on developing two main characters and their relationship together. The way it's built and the way that things happen, and even the comedy that is placed in the episode. There isn't a lot, but the things that happen in it. And, you know, it's probably one of the best episodes that Red Dwarf's ever done, you know, in my opinion.
I would tend to agree with you. I mean, that Marooned episode is, if I'm remembering which one it is, with the guitar, it's, yeah, it's, it's a corker. Like, I mean, it that's a typical trope. That's used in a couple of other comedies as well. Like, Only Fools and Horses use it as well, with Del Boy and Rodney stuck in the lift.
Yeah.
And it's basically Del Boy is trying to get Rodney to admit to his feelings. And it's a really good trope. I like it.
It's interesting to see where that trope can be added in certain things. Like Breaking Bad did it with the Fly episode. Like even I think The Simpsons and Family Guy have done it as well, you know, where it's such a, I've seen it done a lot, but I haven't seen it done as well as in Red Dwarf.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that. Absolutely. Okay, so we're pretty much coming nearly to the end of the podcast. This is a spoiler zone, so you have got the warning, and the warning is happening now. So that was the warning. We are now free to spoil, and we will. The episode that I really want to talk about is Back to Reality, which is the sixth and final episode of Series 5. Now, the reason why I'm picking this episode is because when I watched it at the time, it blew my little mind. This was the first time really that I'd experienced anything that had a different reality, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Nathan, do you remember much about this one?
Yeah, I do, actually. It's actually one of my favourite episodes. One of my favourite characters appears in it. Dwayne Dibley.
Oh, yes. Now, this is a spoiler zone, so if you haven't watched the episode, go back and watch it. Or if you just want to watch it along and listen to us talk shit, that's fine too. Back to reality. Essentially what we have is we have a normal day on Red Dwarf. But then the crew have found a research vessel at the bottom of an ocean planet called the SS Esperanto.
Yes.
And so they go to investigate. And so they get onto the derelict, and they find bodies, not fresh bodies. These bodies have been there for thousands of years, decomposing. But it turns out that every living thing on the vessel has killed itself.
Mm-hmm.
So Crichton runs his checks, panics, and gets everybody back to the ship. And so they get to the ship, they get back to Starbug to go to Red Dwarf. They're suddenly chased by this entity, this creature that a big squid, some sort of space squid.
Mm-hmm.
And they lose their way and they crash Starbug and everybody dies. Or so we think. Up pops the screen, game over, and then next thing we know, our four main characters are being unplugged from this machine that they've been, we're told that they've been playing. The game is called Red Dwarf. They've been participating in it for 4 or 5 years. And basically, they need to go to the next room to gather their belongings and get their memories back. Now, when this happened, this blew my mind, Nathan, because I honestly thought that they killed off my favorite show. It's like, where do you go from here? You fucking, you've killed them all. Everybody is dead, Nathan.
Thank you.
thank you all. So, yeah, it's, I mean, it was at that point that I was like, oh, right, this is interesting. And it is, it's such a such an interesting concept that these, you know, the characters that we know and love then are suddenly different characters.
Yeah.
So I think by them losing their memories and having to use their belongings to try and trigger who they are and things like that, it's a good mechanism for us to get to know them at the same pace. Yeah. Which, again, there's a lot of humor and a lot of hilarity sets in. We find, so essentially what happens is our four characters, Lister isn't Lister. He's a guy called Sebastian Doyle.
Yeah.
Rimmer isn't Rimmer. He is William Doyle, who is Sebastian's younger brother. We have Jake Bullitt, which is a cyborg traffic officer, which is Crichton. And we have the best one, the iconic character that they created, Dwayne Dibley, who was the cat. And it's the interactions. We spend about 10-15 minutes with these guys in the room. Again, it's four people in a room. That's all this is. Yep. It's four people in a room and just bouncing off each other and, please, I don't want to be him. And, oh, maybe I'm this guy. And, oh, yeah, that's a cool name. And it turns out that all the personalities are, they're essentially people that they would not want to be, yeah. Essentially. Lister finds out that Sebastian is some sort of fascist leader of a political party. Rimmer finds out that he's had the same upbringing as Lister, but he's a bum and Lister isn't, so he can't blame things on his family anymore. Crichton finds out that he's got a bit of authority. He thinks he's a cop, but he isn't. He's a traffic control cop with absolutely no authority whatsoever, and eventually goes on to kill somebody, which is against his programming. And the cat basically finds out that Dwayne Dibley has lost all of his cool and all his clothing, and he's got these teeth that could open beer bottles with his overbite. it's those sorts of, you know, it's like fish, literally. I mean, I know fish out of water, and that's, you can take on a couple of different levels there. But yeah, what do you think of all that, Nathan? That's some writing, like.
It is, to create something that you're almost writing the polar opposite of what the writers originally wanted the characters to be, but they wrote it in such a way that you could actually see the shock and the amazement that they aren't who they thought they were, and they're these polar opposites almost, you know. And again, the acting in this episode comes across, it's absolutely fantastic.
It's brilliant. writing. It's absolutely brilliant. So good. I mean, what I really like about it is whenever they're being shuffled off from being unplugged from the machine, the next players come in and they're all sort of buff, handsome guys that come in and sit into the roles. And then when they eventually leave the building, Lister takes a wee sneaky look and like some sort of viewfinder of the current game that's being played. And it's like all the guys are hitting the right buttons. You know, Crichton's good looking. Lister's oiled up and, you know, he gets Chansky. And the cat's really cool. And Rimmer's really handsome and successful and stuff like that. It's just, you know, it's like rubbing salt in the wound. Again, it's another source of humor, yeah. You know. But again, it's sort of, so we eventually then, as I say, they have a little bit of an altercation underground. Rimmer kills a guy because the guy was going to kill a kid. So that's, or not Rimmer, it's Crichton that kills the kid, yeah. Or kills the guy, not the kid. The kid gets away for stealing an apple. It's like the Winslow apple all over again. So essentially then we come out of that reality and it turns out that that reality's fake. We find out that the squid that's on the planet, it's a genetically engineered squid. So it's not an alien. It is an actual life form that was on Earth, but yeah. It's been transmuted to this place and worked on by humans, stupid humans. And basically it has a defense mechanism and its defense mechanism causes despair. And it causes the attacker so much despair that they get this state of suicide and kill themselves.
Yeah.
So we're kind of into that. You know, our guys eventually find a way of neutralizing the toxic agent, and they do come back to reality and destroy the despair squid, and everything is as it should be. But it's, you know, again, it's one of those. It's one of those well-crafted episodes. It was such a good one to sort of end that season on, because the one that was on before it, I think, was Demons and Angels.
Yeah.
And that's another one they could have finished the season on.
Yeah.
But that was a perfect one. And like I say, the show had went on for, you know, this was its fifth season. And I'm looking up my notes here. It actually aired 26th of March 1992. So I was getting ready to do GCSEs at this point. And to be honest, I don't know if I would have survived if they killed off my favorite show.
I was okay. I was three.
You scumbag. You were not three.
I was.
There's no way. Now you're a liar. You're full of it, mate. Another sort of interesting bit about this Back to Reality episode is the cast. Some of the, Red Dwarf was known anyway for having, not in the early days, but in the later sort of episodes, it did have big names in as cast members. And Timothy Spall is the workman that tends to them when they come out of the machine. And Lenny Von Dolan was the cop that gets shot by Crichton. Now, Lenny would have been known. He was in Twin Peaks at the time. So he would have been known, you know, British actor, American audience. He would have been quite well known at that time. So it was kind of nice getting them. And, you know, we talked a wee bit about sort of the funny bits and what happens, but Back to Reality itself was sort of, you know, you can see that's the way virtual reality was back then. I remember the first virtual reality machines. They were not good. They were not good at all. I mean, you're talking about line drawings and, you know, you moved around and your vision was, you know, it had to take a couple of seconds to draw the next frame.
Yeah.
I think it was some like £2 or £3 for 15 minutes. At the Belfast Sports Bowl. You probably don't even remember that.
No.
But you just stood there. You had a gun controller and you had a headset. The headset was massive. Bigger than my head, if you can imagine. And, you know, it was really awkward and stuff. Not like virtual reality today. Virtual reality today is weird. You can do it with your phone and everything now. It's quite frightening where the technology's come from.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, is there any other sort of, I mean, remember, we are in the spoiler zone, so if there's anything else you would like to bring up to spoil?
The whole thing with that whole sort of juxtaposition of each character, Lister's all about free and being free, and and then coming out of the reality game, he thinks that he is a fascist lord, like a
He is.
dictator almost,
He's known as the he's known as the fooder. Is it the fooder colonel, Sebastian Doyle? So immediately it's like, yeah, you sound a bit fascist. You're trying to control votes, and you're a colonel, so you're quite high up. It's almost like some sort of Hitler character,
Yeah, I think I always thought that that was really interesting, and you got to see a different side to the characters that you were used to, and that the scene where they come out of the machine, but it shows you in real time what they're actually doing. The thing they're getting
Yes.
chased in the car.
I
And
have to
again,
admit,
the
that's
physical
all
comedy
that.
there.
I think all that, that's the physical comedy, but it's also budget cutting, because they don't need to put in CGI of like cars going down the street and helicopters chasing them and jumping over ramps and things. No, it's four guys in the hull of a spaceship sitting on crates. Brilliant. Absolutely fantastic. It's like role playing.
I always remember that scene, and always makes me laugh, with them going over speed bumps and stuff.
I know, chicane. Here's a question for you before we wrap up. Did you ever watch any of the American version?
I didn't. I know that Crichton's in it, and he's the only
Yes.
one in it.
Yes. He's the only one from Britain that actually went over. Yes.
Yes, that's what I mean. Sorry. No, I never watched it. I don't actually know too much about it. I know that he actually done a lot of the press for it. He was the main. They spearheaded him for all the interviews, all the sort of talking things on the TV and all the media stuff and the interviews in the magazines, newspapers. They all use Robert Llewellyn. They didn't actually use a lot of the American guys, and I think, unfortunately, that maybe speaks volumes,
Possibly. I mean, what happened was they filmed a pilot in America, and it didn't go down too well. And I think it was written by the Americans. I think it was actually written by the same guy that wrote Malcolm in the Middle, Linwood Boomer. The British comedies that go over to America, there's not very many that succeed at all. There's a lot of pilots get made, but they don't succeed. The humor doesn't transpose too well, or things get too much changed. There's too much change around them. So they portrayed Lister more as a sort of clean cut, nothing remarkable, nothing special, nothing really to say kind of thing. The actor was Craig Bierko. He's been in some of the Scary Movie films and stuff. Didn't do too well. The pilot did not do well at all. It was a couple of unknowns as the cat and Rimmer. Llewellyn was Crichton. Crichton was the only person that they bought over for that. And Holly was actually played by Jane Leaves, who ended up being in Frasier, which is kind of nice wee history tidbit there for her. But essentially what happened was the pilot didn't do well, so they thought they'd have another go at it to see if they could get it right. And they didn't really do so much as a pilot. They did more of a promo. They filmed a couple of new bits with some new people and put on some of the old stuff. The most interesting there is the cat was played by a woman called Terry Farrell, who you'd probably know her better as Jadzia Dax from Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Now, the weird thing is, if because of the timings of this, if Red Dwarf in America was picked up, Terry Farrell would not have been in Star Trek. It would have been a totally different Chadsey at Axe. But, you know, fate has a different a different idea altogether. So yes, it kind of fell dead to the dead to the wayside. But the weird thing was that even though Red Dwarf itself was not remade by the Americans for the American audience, they exported it even more over to America from the British one. And in 1994, the episode Gunman of the Apocalypse actually won an international Emmy.
It was a big deal.
That was a big deal. That's such a big achievement for, you know, it's a show at that time was only running for maybe 6 years.
So that's a great episode as well.
It is. I love Gunman. I think Gunman is a really good one. I didn't really want to cover it because I think everybody's covered that one to death. I wanted to pick a different episode. But yeah, but that's pretty much us, Nate. Anything else you want to add?
No, not really. I just think if anybody's listening and hasn't, give it a go. I'm kind of jealous at you, of you, to be honest, because you get to watch it with fresh eyes, Red Dwarf's had a lot of influence in things. I would say there's Red Dwarf tropes actually in The Simpsons that a
Yep.
lot of people maybe don't pick up on, but there's a lot of
Futurama
things.
as well.
Futurama, Rick and Morty,
Yep.
there's a lot of things that they did first that other people copied and basically put their own spin on it. And if you're a fan, you'll probably know what some of those things are. But it was so influential in my personal life. I've always had a soft spot for it, and whenever I go see my mom and dad and or my sisters and stuff, we're still quoting lines from it near enough on a daily basis. We're saying like, "Oh, how do you do this? Oh, you just simply do that." And then, "Oh, I was with you the whole way up to simply." It's
Yeah.
like just wee simple everyday sayings that we our family has, and we all laugh still, and we all appreciate it, and we're all massive fans still to this day, and I think I've been very, very, very influenced in my sort of interest in sci-fi from such a young age, and that show really kick-started that. And from the things that I'm working on in the background now today, I'm writing a bit of an audio drama set on a spaceship and again a mining facility. All these things, they're all interlinked, and it's had a massive influence in my life, and ultimately it was entertainment, but I've taken a lot of subtle things from that show, that, and in terms of maybe the whole thing about existence and stuff like that, and subconsciously processed that and applied it to my own life, and I think that speaks volume of the quality of the writing,
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, any sort of good writing like that sticks with you.
Does.
I mean, I know that I've said Red Dwarf is on Netflix for all you people out there, but I recently bought all of Red Dwarf on DVD again because I never really owned them all. And I've been watching away at the episodes, the DVD commentaries and the documentaries on them. And just the wealth of, you know, those guys really do like each other. You know, it's there's no other, you know, what a way to spend your living day. You know, what a way to make a living with your mates.
It's definitely a perk of the job, but again, all that ties into the finished product at the end of the day,
Absolutely. Well, yeah, well, I think I'm gonna wrap it up there, Nathan. So, Nate, thanks for coming on here and talking about Red Dwarf. We'll probably cover a couple of other episodes at some point, so I'll get you on again.
Happy days. I appreciate inviting me on for the call. Anytime we get the chat about Red Dwarf, I'm always happy. So
No
thanks very much,
problem.
bro. Thanks.
We'll do that. And guys, thanks for listening. This has been the Red Dwarf episode of The One with the Podcast. Yes, there is a gap there. Mind the gap. Take it easy, folks. Bye.
Yeah.